zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip, heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hello and welcome to My Science Project. My name is Anne and I'll be your host today. The show is the Insect Show. So thanks for joining us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So like I said, this is the Insect Show, and we've got a lot of material to cram in today, and hopefully we'll have time for all of it, because there's a lot of cool stories out there in the insect land. I'll challenge you to tell your honeybee from your bumblebee, just by the sound. We'll talk a little bit, do a little review of something you might have done in high school, biology, about taxonomy and what exactly an insect is. I met with Dr. Judith Myers, who's a UBC expert on caterpillars, and we talked a lot about how caterpillars work as massive groups of several hundred caterpillars to eat and defend themselves. If there's time, we'll talk about the nutritional value of insects and their potential as a novel and widespread food source. And yes, I do have some recipes for you. We might get a chance to spend some time thinking about why on earth we are afraid of bugs. There's all kinds of cool science events coming up this week. I discovered a great new online science magazine, and I hope to tell you about all of those things. So if you're interested in getting in touch with us here at My Science Project, give us a shout, drop us an email at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. So this is the Insect Show, like I said, and I have to confess that pretty much my inspiration for this show was a Tom Waits song from his new album, Ballers, Brawlers, and Bastards. And this particular track is from Bastards, and it's called Army Ants. If you listen closely, you'll hear all kinds of anecdotes lifted from various almanacs and encyclopedias about ant behavior. Well, I'd love to cue that up for you, but it seems to be fickle. So I'm going to have to give that a miss. Perhaps we'll come back to it in just a moment. In place of Tom Waits, I'm going to give you Beatles from Aphex Twin.
Are half the length of their body, and they feed on dead red pine. with their immobile heads inject a paralyzing fluid into their prey that they snatch from life in midair. The snow flea's mode of locomotion, strange and odd, with a spiny tail mechanism with hooks and a protracted tube from the abdomen to enable moisture absorption. The female praying mantis devours the male while they are mating. The male sometimes continues copulating even after the female has bitten off his head and part of his upper torso. Every night, wasps bite into the stem of a plant, lock their mandibles into position, stretch out at right angles to the stem, and with legs dangling, they fall asleep. If one places a minute amount of liquor on a scorpion, it will instantly go mad and sting itself to death. The bombardier beetle, when disturbed, defends itself by emitting a series of explosions, sometimes setting off four or five reports in succession. The noises sound like miniature popgun blasts and are accompanied by a cloud of reddish-colored, vile-smelling fluid. It is commonly known that ants keep slaves. Certain species, the so-called sanguinary ants in particular, will raid the nests of other ant tribes and kill the queen, and then kidnap many of the workers. The workers are brought back to the captor's hive, where they are coerced into performing menial tasks. And as we discussed last semester, the army ants will leave nothing but your bones. Perhaps you've encountered some of these insects in your communities, displaying both their predatory and defense characteristics while embedded within the walls of flesh and passing for what is most commonly recognized as human.
That was Tom Waits giving us a bit of an insight into the diversity of insect behaviors. And this is the Insect Show on My Science Project. And I thought it would probably be sensible to take a minute and think back to something that I definitely learned in late high school in biology. And that's a little bit about taxonomy. And certainly taxonomy is a tricky undertaking and a contentious undertaking when you're trying to stick animals into their various classes. You know, people are always arguing over the true species, whether something is a new species or not, or really just a member of a previously discovered group. But just to give you a reminder of the hierarchy of taxonomy, the groups go like this, starting from the largest: kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. And perhaps you had your own favorite mnemonic for remembering this, but I always remembered it, oddly, by the mnemonic King Philip can only find green socks. Typically each letter there representing kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. And kingdom is the largest group. It is the animalia. Humans fall into that. All animals fall into that. And in terms of getting closer to defining what an insect is, and moving down the taxonomic scale, phylum comes next. And insects fall into the phylum of arthropods. In fact, more than 80% of animals fall into the phylum of arthropods. In fact, just about every creepy, crawly, flying, buggy thing that you can think of is an arthropod. And they often tend to be things that we don't really like thinking about too much, a little bit creepy, a little bit buggy, a little bit tempting to squish. But how you can characterize an arthropod is because they have a segmented body, and each segment has appendages, or legs, if you will. The other key feature of an arthropod is that they have an exoskeleton, and the exoskeleton is made of chitin, which is what provides its defense. As such, they can range in size and appearance vastly. On the microscopic smallest scale, an arthropod is plankton. At the other extreme, the Japanese spider crab, also an arthropod, can be several meters in length. The grouping of arthropods can then be broken down further into subphylums and classes, and that's where insects come in. The class Insecta is made up of 925,000 species or so, which is more than all the other animal groups combined. So it's a highly populated class on the taxonomic lineage. The word insect comes from the Latin for insectus, and insectus means to cut into sections, and just like the phylum it derives from, arthropods, insects are segmented. And usually they have 11 abdominal segments and exposed mouth parts, so that's what makes them a unique group within the larger group of arthropods. So whether you call them Odonata or dragonflies, Hymenoptera or bee, whether you adore them because they produce silk and honey, or you loathe them because they make you itch and they bite you, most of us have had a number of encounters with insects over the years, and with 925,000 species in the class of Insecta, it's not surprising. I found a funny quote from Andy Warhol about these most numerous insects, and he said, "The mosquito is the state bird of New Jersey." Another interesting quote comes from Thomas Eisner, who is the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor of Chemical Ecology at Cornell University. And he's quoted as saying, "To understand the success of insects is to appreciate our own shortcomings." So when you consider that some insects can produce light, think of fireflies, spin silk from their rump or fly, walk on water, work successfully in an enormous team, carry multiple times their own body weight, or jump multiple times their own body length into the air, you begin to see his point. And throughout today's show, you're going to be hearing a lot about how insects have an incredible ability to aggregate and then to work as aggregate groups. And when we return after this tune, I will challenge you to test your ability to tell one bee from another.
Don't I hear you? February 20th, tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon? Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out.
Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness in Canada.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset, 5 p.m. in Montreal, on February 20th and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon.
And if you want to know what stations they are and what the schedule is, check it out at www.ckup.ca.
Hi, welcome back to My Science Project. You're listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. And this is the insect show. We're covering all kinds of material about insects. And coming up is an interview with Dr. Judith Myers on caterpillars, as well as a whole lot of bee buzzing sounds. But before that, I'd like to play for you a poem by Pulitzer Prize winner and former U.S. Poet Laureate Richard Wilbur. And the poem is entitled Mayflies.
Mayflies. In somber forest, when the sun was low, I saw from unseen pools a mist of flies in their quadrillions rise and animate a ragged patch of glow with sudden glittering, as when a crowd of stars appear through a brief gap in black and driven cloud, one arc of their great round dance showing clear. It was no muddled swarm I witnessed, for in Entrechat, each fluttering insect there rose 2 steep yards in air, then slowly floated down to climb once more, so that they all composed a manifold and figured scene, and seemed the weavers of some cloth of gold, or the fine pistons of some bright machine. Watching those lifelong dancers of a day as night closed in, I felt myself alone in a life too much my own, more mortal in my separateness than they. Unless I thought I had been called to be not fly or star, but one whose task is joyfully to see how fair the fiats of the caller are.
That's right. That was Richard Wilbur, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner and former U.S. Poet Laureate with a poem entitled Mayflies. And I took that from the Poetry Archive, which is a fantastic website at poetryarchive.org, giving you access to a searchable database of recorded poems. And clearly there's something on just about everything. We've turned to that source before for poems to play on our science show here. And as I promised, I was going to challenge you to listen to a few buzzing bees and see if you would be able to identify them by their sound. So here's the first sample. We'll see if we can cue that up. There are 3 potential samples that I hope to be able to play for you today. Just struggling a little bit with the first one. Perhaps it won't cooperate. Always a challenge, always exciting to find out what the technical hurdles will be each day that I show up here in the booth. Never mind. What I had, though, for you were 3 sound bites, one of the yellow jacket, one of the honeybee, and one of the bumblebee. And just to verbally differentiate the 3 of those, the bumblebee is a highly visible, visibly furry buzzing bee that you're probably very familiar with. It's a little more gentle than some of the others are. It differentiates itself from the honeybee by being a bit more of the larger bee. And let's see if we can get this going here. So that's your first sample. I've got a couple more to come for you. One of them will be, well, I better not give it away. If you just give me a moment, I'll get those open for you. And I've also got a really great story to tell you about the honeybee. You can hear more in the background, and I'll play them each for you individually in just a moment. Here comes another one. Uh, So they're only slightly different, but I'll play each one for you once more. See if you can identify them. So here's the first one. And there you heard three in succession, three B sounds. And the first one was actually the bumblebee, which is sort of the deeper sound. The final one that you heard is a yellowjacket, which is not actually a bee at all. They're a wasp. They are unique because they have entirely black antennae, and they're also a large stinger. And finally, the last one that you heard was the honeybee, which is a bee famous for storing honey and producing nests of beeswax, or at least that's how it's most commonly known. But really, I think it should be famous for another interesting feature, and it's something that I came across as I was researching the show, which, you know, really just made me giggle. And that's because they use dance to communicate. It's really remarkable, some of the communication strategies that insects do have, and you'll hear a little bit more about them when we play the interview with the caterpillar expert. But here's what happens with honeybees. Obviously, they're heavily involved in seeking out flowers and obtaining their nectar for the production of honey. And so what will happen is that some of these foraging honeybees will head out into the field and perhaps land upon a blossoming lilac bush or other source of nectar. They'll collect their nectar, the honeybee will return to the hive, and then what it does is something called a waggle dance. And the honeybees who have just been successful in foraging food are charged with the intention of informing the fellow bees or recruits where exactly the food source is and encouraging the success of their whole bee population in acquiring as much nectar as possible. And that's where the waggle dance comes in. The returning bees who have identified a source of food perform the dance for these recruits. And the way it works is the bee comes back and it begins this pattern where it waggles in a zigzag line in a single direction, turns right, and loops back to the beginning of that zigzag line. It then follows the zigzag waggly-wiggly line, turns left, and returns back to the beginning. And this is repeated in circuits of 1 to 100 times. Now, what's been studied carefully by scientists is the waggle phase. And the waggle phase has been demonstrated to correlate directly with the distance that the hive is from the food source. So what they've calculated and brought it right down to an exact number is that 75 milliseconds of waggle equals 100 meters distance of the food source. But not only does this waggle dance indicate the distance of this food source, it also indicates direction, because the waggle is conducted in a direction that is directly towards the food source. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, it sounds unbelievable, but what can seem even more unbelievable to me is that Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Dr. Carl von Frisch in 1973 for studying, characterizing, and describing this phenomenon. Now, the work was highly contested at the time by his colleagues, but the theory has stood the test of time, and further studies have been conducted. And what's happened is that von Frisch had demonstrated that the bee dance encoded information about the location and the direction and the distance of the good food sources. But what was still unclear and what remained to be demonstrated to really make this a tight theory was that the recruited bees and the bees who watched the dance, it needed to be demonstrated that these bees absorb the information and then use the information encoded by the waggle dance effectively in their flight pattern to go and find the food. So this proof that recruited bees can read the dance has been the major stumbling block of the von Frisch hypothesis. But in May of 2005, in the highly esteemed Journal of Science Nature, in fact, in volume 435, a group of researchers led by Riley published a paper entitled "The Flight Paths of Honeybees Recruited by the Waggle Dance." And they used harmonic radar to record the actual flight paths of recruited bees. So what they did is they set up an experimental feeder and they set up an observational hive. And the feeder was about 200 meters east of the hive. So they first demonstrated that the bees were able to find the hive. But what the real kicker was here with this study is that they could capture the bees as they were leaving the hive, particularly the bees who had witnessed the waggle dance and should have absorbed some specific information about where to fly. They could relocate those bees, and they could demonstrate that those bees would fly in the same direction, the same distance, as they would have if they'd originated at the observational hive. So if they displaced the bees from the hive and then let them fly, they found that the bees did not fly towards the feeder, but instead made straight flights on the vector that would have taken them to the feeder had they not been displaced. So consequently, their flights were exactly like the recruits who were not displaced. And what this study does is that it provides evidence that bees had prior knowledge of a flight plan, and that prior knowledge had been acquired by watching the waggle dance. And I don't even need to say it, but what is of note here is that all the bees involved in the food foraging and the waggle dance are female bees. Now, it's almost cliched to do it, but I really have one option only of a song to play now, and that's Flight of the Bumblebee. This is David Hefgault.
Thank you.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM, and this is the insect show. And we've covered a little bit about honeybees and what they sound like, yellow jackets, bumblebees, also what they sound like. And what's coming up now is an interview that I've pre-recorded with a researcher at UBC by the name of Dr. Judith Meyer. She's a professor in the Department of Zoology, and her work focuses primarily on population fluctuations of tent caterpillars and also virus infections of the western tent caterpillar, which is certainly one way in which their population might be managed. Now, I spoke with her just the other day and had an opportunity to find out about the kind of work that she's doing, the kind of questions that she's asking. And in just a minute, I'm going to be able to play that for you. I'm just loading in the interview from that. Now, what's kind of fun about chatting with her is that she knows all kinds of things about pheromones and about communication and about the life cycle of the caterpillars. And that's exactly what you're going to hear in the following piece, where I started out asking her about the life cycle of the caterpillar.
But there's different species, and they have different life cycles, but my favorite species is the tent caterpillar, the western tent caterpillar, and they have only one generation a year, so the eggs are on the trees now, waiting for spring to come, and in April, early April, those eggs will hatch. There's about, somewhere around 200 eggs in each little egg mass, and those larvae will hatch out and begin feeding, but they will stay together as a family group and begin spinning silk and form a little tent, and they live on this tent until sometime in June, where they will be fully grown, go off, pupate somewhere. Usually they go down out of the tree, and a couple weeks later they will come out as moths. They only live probably one night as adult moths, so that they will, females will put out their perfume and call in the males, mate, and lay eggs. That's it.
So is it sort of a chance, rare sighting, if you can see a moth?
Well, that's right, because they come out at night, so it makes it even more rare. But they are attracted to lights and windows, so sometimes you see, particularly the males, are more attracted to lights. And so, yes, people don't know what the tent caterpillar moth looks like, most of them, although the males are about a half inch long and slightly purpley brown color. They have feathery antennae. Females are a bit larger, and they're a beigey brown color with slight purple markings on them. The bats probably see a lot more of them than you ever will.
So what are the main predators then of the moths?
It's interesting. The caterpillars, the birds, will not eat, and I think that's because they're hairy and they probably have various chemicals that protect them against being eaten, and that's why they're able to sit on their tents and bask in the sun without having to worry about birds.
So their main predators, I guess, in a sense, are parasites or bugs or...
That's right. So there are flies and wasps that are parasitoid. That is, that they lay eggs on the caterpillars. Those eggs hatch and they develop inside the caterpillar. Instead of getting a moth, then you get a wasp or a fly. But they also have this disease that we have been studying. This it's a virus that's specific to particularly Lepidoptera, some other insects, and that's what really gets them when they're at high density. The disease spreads amongst individuals, and you get what we call an epizootic, and it's pretty ugly.
So do we know why it's dependent on high density to lead to a real effect on the caterpillars?
Well, I think it just spreads very well when they're at high density, so it's important to get multiple individuals infected with the virus, so that's going to happen when they are running into each other. The way it works is that one caterpillar will have the virus. It takes about 10 days. It dies of the virus, and these little balls of protein with the virus particles inside are spread on the leaves. So the whole caterpillar just turns into a little bag of virus. That gets spread on the leaves. It might rain. It might blow around in the wind. Other caterpillars will feed on some of these little balls of virus, and then they get infected. Particularly in the sunny springs, that process can go very quickly because when they're nice and warm, basking in the sun, the virus infection goes very, very quickly. In fact, we thought perhaps that it would be good for them. Maybe that's why they're basking in the sun. They're trying to raise their temperature, as in getting a fever, but it doesn't seem to work that way, that it, in fact, seems to help the virus rather than hindering it.
Do we know what the source of the virus is? Is it just sort of hanging out latently in the caterpillar population?
Well, there are two things, and I'd love to know the answer to that question, but I can't definitively say. But it could be that these little polyhedra do last a long time in the environment and cracks of the bark and things like that. But we also think that it must be in some type of a latent form that's carried in some individuals. And then when the populations begin to increase, there's maybe some stress, maybe some food limitation, that they start getting active infection, and then it can spread very quickly through this high-density population.
Does the caterpillar have much of an immune system?
Well, that's one of the things we would like to know more about. I mean, people didn't think that they did have much of an immune system, and there's more and more being found now that they do have ways of responding to infections. One of the things we were looking at is a reaction of increase in phenoxidase, and some people think that this might help them respond to infections. Our results so far aren't very positive on that, so we'd love to find that. We'd love to know if there is an increase in the resistance of individuals following one of these periods of high infection. Are we getting selection for more resistant individuals? So far, our results seem to indicate no, that's not happening. So,
what's the virus called?
It's a baculovirus, a nuclear polyhedrovirus.
And is it really specific to this tent caterpillar or other insects also?
That's right. It is very specific in this case. So that the western tent caterpillar that we have here in the lower mainland, the virus of that will not infect the forest tent caterpillars that they have right across North America and what the big outbreaks are in Ontario. So those are two species in the same genus, and the virus doesn't cross over. There are other viruses that have been developed for control of insects that have a broader host range. And so there's been a lot of thought that this could be a very effective microbial insecticide because it is so specific. Mm-hmm. But because it's so specific, too, you can't make a whole bunch of money on it. So it hasn't really flourished in its use for controlling insects. Although one of our major forest pests, the tussock moth, there is a virus for that. And it's been used in the last 20 years or so. And so it's very safe because it doesn't affect the other.
Thank you.
interesting because there are a number of different species of caterpillars that go through these population cycles we've been interested in. So it's a pattern of about every 10 years you get outbreaks. And many of those species are gregarious, or they live in groups, family groups often. And partly probably is that by feeding together, that allows them to be able to bite through the leaves, which can get a bit tough, particularly as the summer progresses. For the tent caterpillars, I think it is partly related to their being able to increase their body temperature by sitting together on the tent, basking in the sun. They're very furry. It's like having these little fur coats. They're dark color. They can increase their temperature by 10 degrees centigrade above what the ambient temperature is. So I think that really helps them. It allows them to grow faster. They also work together to find food, find leaves, that somebody will be a leader and head off a trail. They lay silk every place they go. They're making silk, and they also put chemicals on that silk so they can mark, this is a good way to go for food. Don't go this way again because we've eaten all the leaves there. So it's a pretty well-evolved little society, family group there. They will take in caterpillars from other families. They don't seem to recognize the differences between families, but they do tend to stay together as a family. If there's enough leaves around for them to eat.
You mentioned earlier that the female uses a pheromone to attract the male. How does that work?
Well, when the female comes out of the pupa in the late afternoon, and then she starts fluttering her wings, and if given the chance, she will flutter up onto a tree. And then after dark, she will put out these little glands that produce this chemical. The male smells it, follows it, and I think that's a fascinating thing too. How does he follow that gradient to find the female? But they do, and they will mate, and then the female lays her eggs, and that's it for her life. So it's a very short adult period. But these pheromones are very specific to particular species, and they have been developed and used in various types of systems for identifying different moths when you want to know, are they in the area? Have they hatched out yet? Do we need to worry about spraying for caterpillars, that type of thing.
So you can use them to attract the caterpillars and give you a picture of what's
That's right.
in the neighborhood.
So the chemists now are extremely clever at taking small amounts of this chemical, identifying it, synthesizing it, putting it in little rubber cork type things, and then they have these sticky traps. Now you might see these around. They're often green color and look like little tents hanging out in the forest. We see them that they're trapping every summer for gypsy moth in the Vancouver area.
So they're going to attract the moth, and then by attracting the moth give you an idea of how large the caterpillar population is, because that's really what you're
That's right. Right? You assume. So you only catch the male moths, but you assume that that gives you an indication of how many female moths are around as well, and how many there are going to be the next year.
So just to get back to the caterpillars living together and working together as a community, how do they defend themselves against the predators that they do have?
Well, this is one of the neat things about these tent caterpillars, is that they do seem to work together to defend themselves. If they hear a fly parasitoid coming in, buzzing over them, they will rear their heads back and start shaking their heads quite actively, and this puts the fly off, as you can well imagine, particularly since they're trying to lay their eggs on the head of the caterpillar, so they have to have pretty good aim. So particularly on nice, hot, sunny days, the caterpillars are very sensitive to sounds. You can play games with them yourself by shouting at them or coughing at them and get them to react and do this head-shaking behavior.
So they're particularly vulnerable if it's cold?
That's right, yeah. So when it's cold, they don't seem to do this, and it's an interesting thing. Is it too cold for them to move? Is it too cold that it changes how their hairs respond to the vibrations? I don't know, but this does give the flies are able to fly at a cooler temperature than the caterpillars seem to be able to respond to them. So there is a window of opportunity, particularly early in the morning and late in the afternoon, for the flies.
You've just been listening to an interview with Professor Judith Myers from the Department of Zoology here at UBC, and she's given us yet another example of the incredible ability of insects to work as large groups and to communicate within a large group. But enough about scientific research into insects. How about eating insects? And why not? I mean, insects have an incredible nutritional value. I've got a chart here in front of me that compares the nutritional value of various insects per 100 grams, and it draws a comparison to beef or fish. So if you take 100 grams of lean ground beef, you can expect to get about 27.4 grams of protein, low fat, no carbohydrate, no calcium, and a little bit of iron. But if you take that and compare it to 100 grams of small grasshoppers, you know, you're doing pretty well. With 100 grams of small grasshoppers, you can get 20.6 grams of protein, 6.1 grams of fat, 3.9 grams of carbohydrate, 35.2 milligrams of calcium, and a whole lot of iron as well. So, you know, that fixes insects as a pretty reasonable food choice. And why the heck not? You know who else eats insects? Angelina Jolie. And I know that because I read it on the World Wide Web. In fact, Angelina Jolie is quoted as saying that she's planning to learn how to cook insects when she's living in Cambodia. And she's a big fan of the spider soup there. So if you're at a bit of a loss of exactly what to do with insects, it's recommended that you move the legs and wings and fry them or saute them. And how about this? Banana worm bread. Half a cup of shortening, 3/4 cups of sugar, 2 bananas mashed, 2 cups of flour, 1 teaspoon of soda, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 cup of chopped nuts, 2 eggs, and 1/4 cup of dry roasted army worms. Mix it all together and bake it at 350 degrees for 1 hour, and you've got yourself some delicious banana worm bread. Or why not throw some roasted crickets into your chocolate chip cookies? That's recommended by the Department of Entomology at Iowa State University, who's got quite an impressive entomology website. You might want to check it out at www.ent.iastate.edu. It's really pretty remarkable. Now, before I wrap things up and hand things off to Ebony, who's here for her show, Afrobeats, I just want to let you know about some great events that are going on in the city right now, and these are great science events. You might want to check out, actually, the website for UBC's Spencer Museum of Entomology. Rumor has it that it's a little low on funding and not often open, but they do have a great website where they feature a bug of the month, and that's at insecta.com. Also, Vancouver's Café Scientifique is approaching. On February 20th, the café will feature Morley Sutter, UBC Professor Emeritus from the Department of Pharmacology, and Dr. Sutter is an expert in the science and evidence for herbal remedies and has been a collaborator on a CBC documentary called A Pill for Every Ill. So that'll be 7:30 at the Railway Club, and it's a free event. To get more information about that, you can email contact@cafesci-van.com. Also, Science World, they're about to launch a new exhibit called The Story of Chocolate just in time for Valentine's Day, where they'll explore the plant, the products, and the culture of chocolate. That opens February 9th, so I guess that's tomorrow. And apparently, if you go on the weekend, you'll get some free chocolate. The Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology, commonly known as SWIST, is hosting a networking and career fair for women in science and engineering on March 6th. There'll also be a viewing of the Omnimax film Hurricane on the Bayou. There's going to be door prizes. It's $12 to get in, and you need to register by calling Science World or emailing jscott@scienceworld.bc.ca. So that's a really fantastic organization supporting women in science and engineering. And speaking of women in science, I came across this really fantastic online magazine recently called Inkling Magazine, and their website is www.inklingmagazine.com. And Inkling Magazine runs with a subtitle, On the Hunch That Science Rocks. And here at My Science Project, I guess we'd have to agree. What they are doing is just providing all kinds of fun-to-read science-as-they-see-it articles online. It was founded at the end of 2006, and they cover science and everything from what makes you laugh to why you make your breakfast choices. And they do try to target a larger proportion of female readers, but it's really for everyone. So check out inklingmagazine.com. It's a really fun read. And finally, another cool science event going on. February 10th at the Vancouver Institute, Professor Mark Jacquard from the School of Resource and Environmental Management at SFU is giving a talk on fossil fuels, and it's entitled Fossil Fuels, Friend or Foe? And you can find out more about that from the Vancouver Institute. And that has been the My Science Project installment on insects. And thank you for joining us. Here's Chaos coming up with a tune called Flypaper.
Feeling stuck, self-loathing, shoegazing, pesky flies getting you down? Try new supersonic flypaper. It's catchy and it's pop.
Every day, all the people standing at the train station. Left, right, left, right, left, right. We don't talk to each other now. What an alien nation. Uptight, uptight, uptight. I hope one day some things can get better. I hope somewhere our hearts can change the weather. As we walk this yellow road, I try to shake the load in this 416 area code. It's another night in TV line, I see. I'm not one to repeat myself, but if it ain't broken, don't fix it. I see you burning all that midnight oil, but I'm caught between a rock and a hard place. That's why I'm walking in the city with a hard face. Seems I'm afraid of being afraid. You think I don't know, oh how I see ya. Eyes on pride, subliminal pro. I've got to go, plus I couldn't be the pawn in your chess game for fame. But checkmate, I got a new mind state. Plus I got the power of the cat, rotate. I stay digging in my red.